Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 389, recorded on July 18th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from New York is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Bill.
And on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Kelly.
This week on the show, we're talking about pneumatic tubes, whether for mail distribution, in-store cash circulation, or even moving people around a metropolitan area. For a time, during the transition between the first and second industrial revolutions in the mid-19th century, it looked like pneumatic tubes might be the big wave of the future, and they certainly played an important role in certain industries for about a century, and continue to exist in some places today on a limited scale. But ultimately, this vision of the future was not to be. One important thing to remember as we discuss this is that a lot of this experimentation with pneumatic tubes occurred partly in the pre-electrification era, and electrification helped solve many of the same problems that pneumatics were attempting to solve, like avoiding having engines underground, and they usually did so better or more easily than pneumatics did. As we discuss some specifics around mail delivery in this episode, you might also want to refer back for some important context to our U.S. Postal History episode from August 2020, wherein, among other things, we talked about the rising volume of intra-urban postal deliveries during the Second Industrial Revolution within major American cities. But we will also be talking about that in more detail on today's episode. As always, the sources today will be available at arsenalfordemocracy.com with the episode upload, and we found some good ones today for sure. So with that, I will start by turning to Kelly to talk a little bit about the golden era of pneumatic tubes before we get into some of the specifics that I researched and some of the technical aspects that Rachel researched. So Kelly, if you wouldn't mind giving us an overview on kind of the brief peak era of pneumatic tubes when it seemed like going tubular was going to be the way of the future.
Absolutely. So pneumatic tubes are the idea that you can send a solid object through a tube using the power of compressed air or vacuum. So unlike sort of the other pipes within our house or anywhere else that carry liquid, these tubes were designed to carry solid objects. And originally, folks thought that the solid objects that these tubes would carry were people. The original drawings had people sort of strapping into a tube in traveling to their destination through the power of compressed air. This turned out to be impractical over long distances. My guess is that you have never traveled in a pneumatic tube for that exact reason. But there was a prototype that Rachel's going to discuss a little bit later on by Alfred Eli Beach in 1865. The system was eventually shut down, but there were 400,000 tickets sold for the demonstration in the first year. Another early adopter of the technology was the New York City Post Office, which used the pneumatic system across their 23 Manhattan locations and even had an extension into Brooklyn. And they would pack up these 2-foot-long tubes with up to 500 letters and send them to the correct post office. One common theme in reading about this golden era of pneumatic tubes was that people liked sending cats for some reason as like a proof point that these work. So it happened in New York City. It also happened in the North Philadelphia system of pneumatic tubes, where somebody put a cat in a tube and sent it on its way to the vet. The cat ran away as soon as they opened up the tube because that cat was safe, but very, very startled. Eventually, the the increased efficiency of trucks did away with the demand for citywide systems. So folks were no longer using them to send mail from one post office to another post office underground, but there were still uses within a building. So in places like, you know, before the time of email, you might send a letter up to the third floor using a pneumatic tube or forward a fax. But of course, email and faxes then sort of made this building use less common as people had easier and faster ways to connect with one another. However, the novelty did not exactly go away. And there is a McDonald's in Edina, Minnesota, that used pneumatic tubes to deliver fast food that you would order until 2011, when even those tubes were shut down. And so you see this sort of big vision of carrying people over long distances, sort of like narrow down to carrying packages across the city and become a little bit smaller to carrying packages and items within a building. There is still some use of these pneumatic tubes. One use that I thought was interesting was carrying lab specimens quickly across the hospital. So if you're up on the 17th floor, somebody draws your blood, they can send it via pneumatic tube across the hospital to the lab and get it tested quickly. But just to highlight a few other, just to go back to the New York City Post Office example, which was one of the biggest sort of systems of pneumatic tubes, these cast iron tubes, to give you an idea, were buried 4 to 6 feet below the ground. And this is where these canisters with the 500 letters were sent. And at its peak, 1/3 of the mail delivered in New York City traveled through these pneumatic tubes. So about 95,000 letters a day were being hurtled underground via this tube system. The tube system was quite expensive to maintain, with some pretty hefty annual rental payments of over $17,000 per mile. So in 1953, the tube system was discontinued. Bill's going to touch on this in the mail delivery in general. Since 1975, Roosevelt Island in New York City has used these pneumatic tubes to get rid of trash. Sanitation workers sort of send the trash to a compactor via the tubes, where it's reduced to 1/20th of its original size and then loaded up on trucks and trucked off the island. So there still are certainly a few examples of pneumatic tubes being the most efficient way to complete a task and get things from one place to another. And I know we'll be talking a little bit later on about current and future uses, but it is certainly not the people carrying citywide tube system that people one time thought that they would be.
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about the mail stuff now. Let's talk about a piece on the Smithsonian Postal Museum's website from some years ago, probably about 10 years ago now. In the United States, pneumatic mail was experimented with in the largest cities, Boston, New York City, Philadelphia, Chicago, and St. Louis, to varying degrees of success. The system developed by the Western Union Telegraph Company in New York allowed for the transfer of messages between the main and neighborhood post offices and railroad terminals. Installation of the tubes was problematic, with previously laid pipes for sewage and gas limiting the size and thus the amount and kind of mail a pneumatic tube could carry. Water table levels also presented difficulties. In Philadelphia, some parts of a pneumatic mail system had to be buried 22 feet deep or 10 feet below the level of the water. Pneumatic mail service was also expensive, and this goes back to a point that Kelly alluded to, which was surprising to me, about the sort of privatization or the preserving of the private role in the middle of this public mail delivery service. Since the tubing was dug, laid, and owned by private companies, the cities had to pay rent and labor. In Brooklyn alone, in 1898, the yearly cost ran from $87,500 to $152,597, depending on the number of branch offices served on the line. Mail was transferred between New York City and Brooklyn over the Brooklyn Bridge, a line that itself cost $14,000 in rent per year and $6,200 in labor. However, some cities were willing to pay the price for speed. Mail carried in pneumatic tubes traveled at speeds as fast as 35 miles per hour. Pneumatic mail service seems to have enjoyed its greatest success in New York City. Distances that had once taken up to 40 minutes by mail wagon could be covered by a cylinder sent through the pneumatic tube network in as little as 7 minutes. Each cylinder, at least the ones in New York City, could hold 600 letters. Mail sorting also benefited by the use of cylinders, whereas the large loads of mail delivered by streetcars had to be sorted immediately on site. Mail delivered by cylinder could be dispatched and sorted at intervals, and the entire load would be sorted and distributed before the streetcar could even reach the station. Pneumatic tube mail was one of the factors leading to the demise of mail by streetcar. Eventually, New York City would be covered by 27 miles of pneumatic tubes. Pneumatic tube mail was used in New York City until the 1950s. Service between Brooklyn and New York City was discontinued in April 1950 because of repairs on the bridge and was never restored. Service was suspended in 1953 for the rest of New York City pending review. It had never been reinstated. However, use of pneumatic mail systems survived in Paris until 1983, when it was finally replaced by telexes and fax machines. The same sort of pneumatic dispatch system is still in use today at large stores such as Sam's Club and Home Depot, hospitals, and most familiar to most of the public, banks across the United States. And so there's some interesting points in there. Obviously, I should have emphasized this earlier, just the fact that we are focusing on the United States. Rachel's going to maybe allude to a little bit of stuff happening in France and Britain during the earlier period. But this show predominantly focuses on the United States, so that's why we're focusing on it in this one. But again, you see that sort of pattern where there's this big increase, as we talked about in our August 2020 episode about the U.S. Postal Service. There's this phase where you have just enormous volumes of mail happening within a given city, just even between businesses in the financial districts, especially things like that. It's, you know, same day mail. There's multiple delivery times every day. You're just sending back and forth tons of mail. And as soon as you have something that's either electrically based or electronic based that everyone can use, as opposed to a telegraph, which requires a specific operator with training, as soon as you have something like a telephone in every office or even on every desk to make it even easier, or eventually fax machines, telexes, internet, email, things like that, you dramatically reduce the volume of things that need to be moved within a given day between buildings in a city. And you obviously still have some package type delivery that needs to happen. But in many cases, now you've reduced the other traffic that's happening in such a way that you can make it more easy to deliver those things, or you just use courier services and things like that. But when they were experimenting with these pneumatic tubes and thinking this was going to be the wave of the future, this was before telephones. This was before you'd have those type of competing services, and you would have, you know, kids running around with message deliveries or, you know, multiple mail deliveries per day to try to cope with the volume of mail between various offices and buildings and so forth during the day, during within a single city. And this was an attempted solution to that. And as I said at the top of the show, a lot of things you can see why it would be a better solution than pneumatics. But there was an era where it looked like this was going to be pretty significant. And in some cities, it definitely did have a fairly significant role, like Kelly said, with delivering, say, a third of the mail on a given day in New York City by pneumatic tubes. Now, Rachel has done some research on kind of what was happening in some of the other countries that led to adoption or attempted adoption in the United States, some of the technical aspects of how these pieces of equipment worked and so forth, and kind of what the ideas were for human transportation that never really ended up panning out, but were at least attempted. There were some slightly more successful test concepts more extensively in the United Kingdom that we're not going to really get into, but there were some interesting things to talk about with regard to the United States. So, Rachel, I will turn to you now.
Yeah, so I found kind of a technical schematic, a very, very simplified technical schematic, on the website for the Museum of Retro Technology, which is found on archive.org on the Wayback Machine. So basically, the central concept is there is a centralized stationary exhaust fan powered by steam engine, whether by gas or some other means. and it's used to move the air in a circular motion through a tube, like a circuit of tubing. And so when you open an inlet valve to put in a canister or an item carrier, the pressure from the moving air kind of sucks up the carrier into the system, and then it travels through the system through its final destination. And the inlet door is often closed automatically by this negative air pressure created by the air circulating. Once the carrier arrives at its destination, gravity takes over, and it just kind of drops through a discharge door, and the air is circulated back towards the inlet door in this never-ending circuit, basically. It's very simple, but that's kind of an easy way to visualize it. So Great Britain was the big innovator in this technology. And starting in 1853, but with improvements completed in 1870, pneumatic tubes were used to create a central telegraph dispatch. So telegraph forms were sent from local post offices to a central telegraph office in London. This was a huge benefit to the local post offices, as they were only required to employ tube attendants rather than the skilled labor of a telegraphist. So it allowed them to cut down on labor costs by just employing these tube attendants that were only required to send packages through the system rather than having that skilled labor as a telegraphist. As Bill mentioned, there were systems in France, specifically Paris and Marseille. In Paris, it opened in 1874, and then Marseille's system opened in 1910. So in this system, there wasn't really a postal service that was being used to carry messages within the cities. Messages were sent to the closest stop on this route, and then the last leg was performed by a courier. So it seems like it was much less formalized than a traditional postal system. Messages in these systems traveled at an average rate of 1 kilometer per minute, and the Paris system had three major circuits. Outward trips were propelled by air pressure from the rear, and then return trips were powered by vacuums, kind of sucking the carriers back to their home. Some pumps in Paris were powered by pumping water into the system to increase air pressure. As the volume decreased in the system, the pressure increased. This was done in areas where steam-powered pumps were just too noisy, and I thought that was a really elegant solution to this noise problem in probably the fancier areas in Paris. In the U.S., the first pneumatic tube system was introduced in Philadelphia in 1893, and by 1915, Philadelphia, as well as Boston, Brooklyn, New York, Chicago, and St. Louis, had in total more than 56 miles of tubes in use. So there really was this this golden era, this peak. That was actually pretty impressive. 56 miles is a pretty impressive figure. Another source that we looked at was a booklet compiled out of press clippings in 1868 by Alfred Beach, who, as was mentioned earlier, unsuccessfully tried to promote a pneumatic power railway in New York, and he did get a short concept section built that was kind of a novelty. So Beach aspired to speeds reaching 100 miles per hour, which was four times the speed of what locomotives at the time were capable of. He also pointed out that the weight of the cars would be much less than with locomotives, and the cost of wear and tear would be less as well. And I can see in a system where electrification didn't exist, or the widespread use of trucks and other motor vehicles didn't exist, this might have been a bit more attractive. However, those things did occur, and the pneumatic passenger system wasn't quite as effective as he was hoping. In 1867, he also extolled the cost savings of the passenger pneumatic system compared to other transportation projects. He estimated the PT system would cost $100 per foot, which would have been much cheaper than the Brooklyn Bridge, which was still in the planning stages at this time. Building would begin in 1869. So he was trying to show that he could move people around in a much more efficient, much cheaper manner than this proposed Brooklyn Bridge. And there are some great pictures in this source, which will be linked in the show notes, On page 37, there's a great picture of the passenger cars where it looks kind of like an amusement park ride. You're basically in a giant tube, getting strapped in like a car in a roller coaster, basically. So it looks like it would have been pretty fun to ride, even if only for one New York City block. Much more practical was this concept for the postal system, which did come to fruition and had much longer lasting success than passenger pneumatic travel. And like Bill mentioned, the system was very clever. It separated the incoming mail from the depots on its route, so it could be more efficiently sorted and delivered. And there's a quote from this, which kind of goes into the facts and figures of the cost of what the pneumatic system could do versus merchants moving their wares separately using horse-drawn conveyances. But all this is a sort of excrescence, the growth of a few recent years upon the main body of our system of street transportation. The public cartmen number upward of 7,000, with 275 public porters. Of the private carts and wagons belonging to our wholesale merchants, manufacturers, and large retail houses, we can only make inadequate conjecture so as to be within bounds. Of our 8,000 wholesale merchants, at least 1,000 have their own carts. The manufacturers, who for the most part cannot dispense with private wagons, cannot possibly have less than 2,000 of these in motion. Here are 10,000 vehicles in the wholesale way. Then we have 17,000 retailers and 11,000 in mechanical trades. Of these, some 3,000 grocers and 2,000 butchers and bakers must have, nearly all of them, wagons for the collection of their numerous daily supplies of goods or materials, as well as for distribution to their customers. Allow them 4,000 wagons and let the other 12,000 retailers have 1,000 more. Total of public and private business vehicles, 15,000, beside expresses. Give them a low average of 30 parcels per day. Many of them carry hundreds. We have a total movement of 450,000 parcels. To these, add 15,000 out-of-town express parcels, 15,000 suburban, and 30,000 city, and we have a total of 510,000 per day. 500,000 of parcels and packages already passing through our streets daily by horsepower, to which we might fairly add 100,000 more by hand, furnish the existing basis of business strictly legitimate for the pneumatic dispatch, and capable of being transacted by that agency at a decisive saving in cost. The latter fact will be apparent on a simple calculation. The cost of a horse in the city, well cared for, is found by accurate account to be about 65 cents per day. The wages of employees are about $3, and the earnings of cartmen $5 or $6, at the lowest. Allow the men an average of $4, and let the wear of wagon and harness, with the expenses and wear of the horse, make up $1 a day. Too little, everyone will say. But here are over 17,000 horses, as many wagons, and as many men, maintained at a minimum cost of $85,000 per day, which is an average cost of 17 cents for every one of the 500,000 parcels they are supposed to carry. Of course, the price paid, directly or indirectly, must be higher. Anyone generally acquainted with such prices in the city will admit that 25 cents would be a medium estimate for the average. Reduce this price to an average of 10 cents, which would be a lucrative rate for pneumatic transportation, and you have instantly the proper condition for doubling the business, which the quickness, certainty, and facility of the new method would soon double again. Again, as to capital, here are 17,000 horses, worth, on an average, $300 each, and as many wagons and carts, worth an average of $200 more, making a total capital of $8,500,000 invested in this business in the form of horses and vehicles alone, enough to extend the pneumatic system through every thoroughfare of the city twice or three times over. So he really was putting some numbers behind his concepts, and he really did want to increase the efficiency of business, increase the flow of goods and services moving through the city. But I think, as we've mentioned before, just the technology didn't quite keep up with motor vehicles or any other types of conveyance that were just much, much cheaper and much more efficient than this pneumatic system.
Kelly, do you want to talk a little bit about the future of pneumatic tubes? I mean, you've mentioned a few examples, as have I, of ways in which it's still in use, but this is not something that's ever completely gone away, despite what we've just talked about its relative disadvantages.
Yeah, absolutely. I was surprised to learn to that point that the pneumatic tube industry is still a $50 million industry in the U.S. Certainly email has replaced the need like to send letters from floor to floor, but there's still a need to transport tangible things within a workplace, like parts or samples, like the hospital samples example that I mentioned earlier. And there have been some significant improvements to this system. One of the ways in which it's improved is that there are now softer landings for tubes in the system. So you used to sort of just like plunk down, but they're able to use to create tubes now that give a little bit of a softer landing. Additionally, computers and software are able to prevent some of the human mistakes. One of the articles I read gave the example of a blood sample and a urine sample being sent sort of in different directions via the same tube and having a pretty like catastrophic collision. But of course, with the advent of computers, these systems are now able to prevent those sorts of human errors. One serious limitation is that these systems require space. So for example, the underground system in New York City is not coming back anytime soon. Underneath New York is now very congested with sewer wires, subways, etc. And it's been estimated that it would cost between $6 and $9 billion to install the same pneumatic tube system that was here 70 years ago. And so that sort of system isn't coming back. But this within the building system, there's still a place for in some workplaces. Another very prominent example is Elon Musk's idea for a Hyperloop. The Hyperloop would rely on the same compressed air technology, as well as the increased safety functions through sort of like computerized launches and safe landings, and really being able to see where the carriers are at each point in the tube as they go through. Hyperloop is very much an idea at this point with no real plans to make it a reality, but just goes to show that sort of everything old is new again at some point, and that there are still spots where this is the technology that makes the most sense to use.
Yeah, I mean, the Hyperloop is just completely sort of a made up thing. I mean, literal pipe dream at this point. Yeah, and pneumatic tube networks, I would just note, do remain popular subjects for heist plot lines in movies and television. I think especially because, you know, people can go and, you know, to a Home Depot or something like that, or a bank, and see a pneumatic tube system in use. So then it gives them the idea for, you know, writing something into a script. That movie from a few years ago, Logan Lucky, that involves a heist at a NASCAR track with cash from a tube system during a race getting stolen. The show White Collar, about a decade ago, there was a season involving reactivating that New York postal tube system to move some stolen cash. In general, also, I would encourage people, if you want to know more about some of the pneumatic transportation attempts for moving people around rather than objects and mail, the show Well, There's Your Problem, which we've talked about plenty of times and had one of the hosts on. In February of 2020, episode 17, they covered the atmospheric railway. Now, they briefly touch on the New York concept one that Rachel talked about, which would have moved people inside the tubing. The atmospheric railway was another concept tested in England or Ireland, where you would, instead of having the entire vehicle be inside a tube, you would just have it sort of like a cable car, where there's a smaller tube underneath it that is providing the sort of motive power to yank this object along. And as you can imagine, they ran into some pretty spectacular problems with that concept pretty quickly. But it's got some interesting material in there as well. Any closing thoughts from either of you before we wrap up our pneumatic tubes episode today?
Well, I work in a lab, and I think a pneumatic tube system would be very, very efficient for moving lab samples to the various departments where the testing occurs. We do have a centralized accessioning like room that would be perfect for kind of setting up this system. I think I should push it up the chain of command and see if anybody bites, but I highly doubt it. It would just be probably for like the novelty factor of pushing samples through a tube system, and how exciting that would be.
Kelly?
Again, this is just another thing that I had never really thought about before. And so I am glad for the opportunity to think about sort of past, present, and future of these tubes and sort of as we watch technology evolve in front of us.
I also want to let listeners know that we had mentioned a couple weeks ago that we were making some changes with regard to the Patreon, which we had to do. We talked about scheduling challenges at the time and didn't really get more specific than that, you know, partly because we're leaving things open-ended. I do have an opponent this year for my reelection campaign, so that's kind of what happened there and just needed to scale back. So we no longer have the $5 a month tier on Patreon. It's just a $3 a month tier, and we've stopped doing the bonus episodes. So $3 a month, you're not really getting anything much more than our gratitude and maybe helping to fund some special episodes at some point. But, you know, if you want to support the show, $3 a month, that might be easier for some people than $5 a month. So I would encourage you to go to patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy and subscribe if you like episodes like we did today. This was kind of the type of thing we were doing on a lot of the bonus episodes. And this probably would have been a bonus episode, but we moved it up to the main feed instead. But I would just appreciate if people listen to the show, you know, it would be great if you could subscribe to that. If not, that's okay. These episodes will continue to be available once a week, usually on Sunday or Monday, from our website, arsenalfordemocracy.com, or from, you know, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, etc. Kelly, thanks for coming on this week to talk about pneumatic tubes in the United States.
Thanks for having me. Nice to talk to you, Bill and Rachel.
And Rachel, thank you for being on to talk about this as well.
Yeah, it was a really fun topic.